The roadless areas are the heart and soul of the Tongass. These are the wild, natural places.
A federal move to protect national forests from logging. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 29th of May. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Redoubt Volcano changes its eruption formula.
This eruption has been a bit different, though sometimes a volcano doesn't even behave its own rules.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The H1N1 swine flu has reached Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water, or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay home if you're sick and contact your healthcare provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
The Obama administration is taking a second look at new Forest Service timber sales in roadless areas. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the new directive announced yesterday requires prior approval by the Secretary of Agriculture before logging is allowed in roadless areas of national forests.
In announcing the interim directive Thursday, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack said it would provide consistency and clarity that will help protect our national forests until a long-term roadless policy is developed. The new directive will apply to the national forest in Alaska, including the Tongass. There are 9.5 million acres of roadless areas within the Tongass National Forest. Of that, 2 million acres are available for timber harvest. Tongass National Forest spokesperson Phil Salmon says the directive doesn't mean all road building and timber harvest on roadless areas is off limits, but instead that there will be a higher level of scrutiny.
This interim directive doesn't necessarily stop a project just because it has the project boundaries and inventoried roadless area, but it does require this procedural oversight step to make sure that the work that's being done is actually something that's vitally necessary for a natural resource reason or some other specific objective that has to be met. So this is another step that is held at the Secretary's level.
Salmon says timber sales in roadless areas previously approved by the Forest Service will not be affected by the interim directive.
This directive only applies to projects that have not been decided. So any project that has had a signed decision and already been out to the public, those projects are not impacted at all.
The new directive is being praised by environmental groups who were hoping the Obama administration would make a break from Bush administration forest management policies. Juneau-based Earth Justice attorney Tom Waldo says the directive is great news for the Tongass.
The roadless areas are the heart and soul of the Tongass. These are the wild, natural places that people in this region love for hunting and fishing, recreation and tourism and subsistence.
Although Vilsack could conceivably approve timber sales in roadless areas while the directive is in place, Waldo believes that is unlikely.
We hope that this leads to a policy for protecting the roadless areas and not just a procedural review.
This is the latest chapter in an 8-year battle over protection of roadless areas in the country's national forest system. During the final days of his presidency, President Bill Clinton issued a sweeping rule that protected roadless areas from road building and timber harvests. After a series of court challenges and a change in direction on the part of the Bush administration, harvests in roadless areas have resumed. Alaska Forest Association Executive Director Owen Graham says it's too soon to tell if all Tongass roadless areas will once again be off limits for timber harvests. If that's the case, he says Southeast Alaska's already struggling industry will continue to shrink. Graham hopes the Obama administration will instead choose to stick with the most recent version of the Tongass Land Management Plan.
Hopefully they'll just look at this thing and understand that Alaska's unique, just like some of the other states are, and not impose their will on and put us further out of business.
The interim directive does not apply to Idaho. It will last for 1 year and can be renewed for an additional year. in Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Arctic Village is hosting a celebration this weekend to mark two decades protecting the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. As KUAC's Dan Ross reports, the events, including a unique art project, are aimed at local and global environmental concerns.
Arctic Village is one of several Gwich'in Athabascan communities that depend on the porcupine caribou herd, which calves on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge's coastal plain. Gwich'in Steering Committee Chairperson Sarah James of Arctic Village says this weekend's gathering will bring together those who have worked to protect the refuge.
We're celebrating as a Gwich'in nation that we keep the oil drilling out of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for 20 years since 1988 when we took that position as a nation. 15 chiefs and 15 villages united.
James says 75% of the Gwich'in diet consists of foods that come from the land. She says the world's appetite for fossil fuels threatens subsistence through direct development and climate change. People from across the north and around the world are expected in Arctic Village this weekend, including environmental artist John Quigley. Quigley says the Arctic Village project follows on several years working with indigenous peoples on environmental causes.
In 2005, we created an image on the sea ice in the eastern Arctic of Canada with Shilawat Cloutier and Inuit leaders there, sending an Arctic warning to the world about the effects of climate change. And as the world is leading up to a new climate treaty in Copenhagen this year, I went back to Shilawat Cloutier about possibly sending another message from the north, and she recommended that I come to Alaska. And so I connected at the Indigenous Peoples Climate Summit with Sarah James, who's one of the heroes of the movement. And that's where the plan for this event came about.
Quigley makes what he calls aerial human art, in which people arrange themselves into images and words on the ground that are then photographed from the air. He says the Arctic Village project will depict a caribou and an environmental message. Other events planned for this weekend include sharing of traditional foods and native dancing. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Starting Monday, June 1st, Americans crossing the border with Canada will need a passport or a comparable document. A passport is already needed for air travel between the U.S. and Canada, Mexico, the Caribbean, and Bermuda. But now it will also be required for land and sea border crossings. A spokeswoman for Customs and Border Protection, Joanne Faria, says the agency is ready for the deadline.
I can tell you that we're ready. We've been working on this. We have the technology ready. The documents are available. We have been communicating with the travelers and getting this information out. We are ready for June 1st.
The travel document requirements are part of the Departments of State and Homeland Security's Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative. There are alternatives to having a passport, including a passport card. Faria says these special cards are cheaper and can be used only for land and sea travel.
Well, it's a less expensive option, and if you don't plan to travel internationally by air and you live near the border or you cross the border frequently, the passport card is an option for you.
A passport costs $100, while a passport card costs $45. Both last for a decade, but take a month or more to get. The U.S. Government Printing Accounting Office produced a record-breaking 24 million passports last fiscal year. About a million passport cards have been issued. Another alternative to a traditional passport is a Trusted Traveler Program card for frequent border crossers. Applicants go through a background check and interview in order to qualify. Despite Monday's rule changes, Customs and Border Protection's Joanne Faria says Americans returning home won't be turned away at the border if they don't yet have a passport or a passport card. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an education on the life cycle of salmon in Sitka.
In the summertime, we have all these tourists from all over the place that don't know too much about salmon except that they're good on a plate.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The lightning-caused broken snowshoe fire near McGrath has consumed more than 22,500 acres. The fire began on May 25th and is now threatening primary residences, cultural resources, and private property. The blaze is on Native Corporation land with high timber value. Dry fuels and almost no rain have made it a difficult fire to fight. 12 fire crews are working to save structures and have established anchor points on the fire's western flank. Public Information Officer Gary Linhausen is in McGrath.
We woke up this morning to light rainfall, and we only had 4 hundredths of an inch of rain, which doesn't really have a big effect on the fire. But what it does do for us is have a cooling effect on the fire and allows firefighters to get up close to the edge of the fire and work on containment lines. The last 2-3 days, most all of our firefighting resources have been committed to structure protection, trying to secure the cabins that are located along the Takotna and the Kuskokwim River.
He says efforts to save cabins have been successful, and efforts are moving to the perimeter of the fire in an attempt to contain it until cooler, wetter weather arrives on Monday. As of today, the village of Takotna and the community of McGrath are protected by rivers along the western and southern borders of the fire. 90% of the firefighting resources are concentrated on containing the western and southern flanks of the fire. Linhausen says at this time there is currently no danger the fire will jump either river.
If we had a day or two of hot, dry weather, say 80 degrees, and humidities around 20% or lower, and some wind, just about anything could happen. You know, if we don't have those kind of conditions, I would say, no, there's no chance of that happening. But if those conditions come to pass, then there's cause for worry.
Linhausen says on the positive side, fire suppression resources are ample right now because the broken snowshoe fire is about the largest one in the country at this time. The 2009 eruption of Mount Redoubt volcano is now in its 10th week, and staff of the Alaska Volcano Observatory continues its round-the-clock vigil. As KBBI's Marsha Lynn reports, forces at work within the mountain could cause a new eruption at any time and with little warning.
Thick, pasty lava flows spewing from the mountain's summit have created a dome that measures about 40 million cubic meters and contains enough material to fill 11 Louisiana superdomes. Redoubt hasn't acted up for quite a while, and Steve McNutt of the AVO says if this lull continues, the dome could get even larger.
The current dome is actually smaller based on photographs than the largest of the domes in 1989-90. So what that means is just first order, it could grow quite a bit more. The previous lull in 1989-90 was, I think, about 31 days, and we're up to about 47 or 48 days now. So it's fairly long, but as long as the dome continues to grow and if it remains and becomes unstable, then a dome collapse could easily trigger another explosive eruption.
He describes the nature of such a blast.
It's growing on the edge of a steep slope. You know, it's molten rock, which is irregular and not the strongest of geologic material. So at some point, the thing will just collapse gravitationally under its own weight and move down the steep slope. And when it does that, that will crumble the molten rock into small particles, which will rise up as an ash cloud.
Lately, steam plumes rising thousands of feet in the air have been seen from various places around the Kenai Peninsula. McNutt says their visibility is weather-dependent.
The amount of steam and activity at the mountain in general has been pretty steady for the last several weeks, but the weather conditions and meteorological conditions vary, and depending on how much moisture is in the air and how quickly the steam condenses, the plume can look higher and bigger and more dramatic, or alternately smaller and less active.
McNutt says they are also looking below the surface at the many earthquakes occurring beneath the dome that might possibly trigger landslides and more volcanic activity. And he says readout volcano is simply defying previous patterns.
Most of us used the 1989-90 eruption as a benchmark, but this eruption and the whole sequence of events has been a bit different. So sometimes a volcano doesn't even behave its own rules.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory website at avo.alaska.edu provides a range of information and updates on the Mount Readout volcano. In Homer, I'm Marsha Lynn.
Southeast Alaska's biggest Native corporation and its largest tribal organization are developing new business partnerships. Leaders say they hope to provide employment and services for villages and other economically strapped parts of the region. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld filed this report.
Sea Alaska is Southeast's regional Native corporation with 20,000 shareholders and annual earnings of more than $100 million. Tlingit Haida Central Council is Southeast's largest tribal organization with about 26,000 members and a government-to-government relationship with the United States. Both are trying to develop new businesses benefiting residents and the communities they live in, and they recently decided to combine some of their efforts. The corporation and the Central Council signed a memorandum of understanding this spring. Sea Alaska Executive Vice President Rick Harris says they're just getting started with the effort.
We're agreeing to review each of our respective capabilities and then to be able to identify business opportunities or business enterprises that give us an opportunity that others wouldn't be able to fulfill.
Both are able to get preference for some federal contracts, sometimes without competitive bidding, and both are looking into federal economic stimulus programs. Central Council President Bill Martin says combining resources might help.
Usually a tribe will have a better chance of obtaining contracts and things like that from the government over the private enterprise of Sea Alaska. But at the same time, they have funding that we don't and other resources that we can use.
Martin points to a Central Council effort a few years ago that created jobs in Hoonah and Kluwak. Tribal members converted paper military documents into an electronic format and provided other services such as proofreading. He says problems with the contractor ended the enterprise, but it was still a good model of bringing jobs to villages. Sea Alaska and Tlingit Haida also hope to develop businesses that increase their own revenues. Harris says that will help advance economic self-sufficiency and self-determination.
We're still in the early development stages, but the most important thing is that we've really stepped back and realized that both those had some very significant competitive advantages, and that by working together, we were able to enhance those advantages, and we believe that we can create some very strong business opportunities in the region.
Sea Alaska operates logging, gravel, and other businesses in Southeast, and the Central Council operates a vocational school in Juneau and a business development center in Angoon. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The Alaska Division of Elections has been working to improve their UBIC translation program. Top members of the division were in Bethel on Wednesday to inform local tribes about those changes. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
About 50 people attended the outreach meeting held at the Cultural Center. Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai says her staff has been building off the work they did in the most recent October elections that election day marked a big step in Yupik language assistance.
Well, we've always done oral translations, but this is the first time we actually had some written documents that the poll workers used.
Vanumiai says the outreach program was aimed at letting the region know what kind of translation assistance will be implemented for the next election. This isn't the first time the Division of Elections has implemented a written language assistance program. They've been providing that assistance to speakers of Tagalog on Kodiak Island since about 2002. That's the most popular Filipino dialect spoken there. But Tagalog has been a written language for much longer than Yupik. Election system manager Shelley Groudon says that making a uniform glossary of Yupik translations is one of their top priorities now.
Hearing from the different villages about the various different dialects and the differences in the language from village to village, it definitely is a challenge for us to come up with understandable election terms and glossaries.
One of the village representatives attending the meeting is Theodorcia Seaton of Cuitlic. She reads a translation from the draft glossary provided by the Division of Elections.
Apiun statum acutine kmangkakit at dumalhgatn.
According to the glossary, that's a translation for bond proposition. Literally translated, it comes out to a question appearing on the ballot about spending money. Seaton translated at the polls last October. I asked her how she would have translated bond proposition without the glossary.
If they didn't have that, let me see, bond proposition. I'd probably have to ask somebody way older than me if they know anything about it, or anybody that has background regarding, you know, words like that.
The glossary project is being headed by Dori Wassily. She's the Yupik Language Program Coordinator. She created a translation panel composed of Yupik teachers, orthographers, and oral historians. She says their wealth of knowledge helps to whittle down the best translations for other terms like absentee voting and precinct registration. But Wassily says it's a painstaking process.
One translation can take anywhere from half an hour to 45 minutes to an hour because, you know, for one word or for one term, there is like seven or eight translations, and then we have to get together and say, okay, what is this, the best translation that matches the very closest.
The translation panel will meet again to finalize translations in the glossary before they are distributed for the October elections. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The red salmon return on the Copper River is coming in better than anticipated. State Area Management Biologist Mark Somerville says indicators point to a strong early run.
The commercial fishery out of four openers so far have caught a little over 300,000 sockeye. So the sockeye return looks very strong at this point.
Somerville says the much smaller Copper River King run has so far been weaker than expected. The first opening of the upriver personal-use dipnet fishery at Jitna is scheduled for June 1st through the 7th. It's the first time in several years that such a long initial opening has been scheduled. Somerville says it reflects better-than-expected sockeye migration past the state's Copper River sonar fish counter at Mile Lake.
For the week, actually May 18th through May 24th, through the sonar counter, we had nearly 60,000 fish come through the counters. We expected about 40,000.
Somerville says the king take could be ratcheted down if the run continues to come in substantially weaker than the forecast. And despite the closing of Sheldon Jackson College 2 years ago, the education program at the former college hatchery is still in full swing. An organization called the Sitka Sound Science Center has been releasing fish from the hatchery all week. KCAW's Emily Schwing reports.
If you get too many in the net, just let some of them go. When you pick up on the bottom, you carry it over, turn it inside out.
For the past week or so, contract hatchery manager and former Sheldon Jackson educator Dan Goodness has been heading up the release of coho salmon smolt from the Sheldon Jackson hatchery.
What you're seeing, in essence right here, is what this program is all about. These students that are here helping with the release, they're learning about the Pacific salmon and their life cycle,
and they're getting hands-on experience doing it.
While classes at the college ended nearly 2 years ago, Goodness, along with volunteers like Susan Brown, have continued both operations and the education program at the hatchery.
The college is closed. Nobody told the fish, but we are still educating, not college students, but we're educating people of all ages. We have school children come through of different ages, and then in the summertime, we have all these tourists from all over the place that don't know too much about salmon except that they're good on a plate.
The SJ Hatchery is currently contract operated by the Sitka Sound Science Center. Last year, the state of Alaska appropriated $250,000 in funding for the hatchery, but this year that money didn't come through. Goodness says operations currently rely on other government grants and private donations.
Unofficially, I believe right now that there's probably somewhere between 5 and 6 months worth of funding left. I don't see how the hatchery could close down because individuals in Sitka like myself are not going to allow it to happen.
Before the Sitka Sound Science Center was contracted to oversee operations at the hatchery in early 2008, Dan Goodness and Susan Brown ran it themselves on a voluntary basis for the month of December 2007. Recently, Goodness, a group of local sixth grade students, and a handful of teenagers were tasked with releasing the last group of 150,000 smolts that have been reared at the hatchery over the last 2 years. 16-year-old Carrie May has seen the process from start to finish.
For like the past year, so me and my mom have been coming down here and volunteering. So we've done every part. We've tagged the fish. We like picked out all the dead eggs. And so this is the final part. And so we just wanted to come and down and help out and see them go. I'm just excited for them to come back and eat them. You can't help it. I mean, they're good.
May says she plans on studying marine biology when she heads off to college in a few years, which is exactly what biologist Dan Goodness is aiming for. He says he'd like to continue the tradition of environmental science education as it existed when he was still teaching classes at Sheldon Jackson.
It made me very sad when the college suddenly shut down in 2007, and so my dream come true is for college students to come back here, because I'm ready.
In Sitka, I'm Emily Schwenk.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Marsha Lynn in Homer, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Emily Schwing in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.